Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival 2019. My name is Rebecca Harkins-Cross. I'm a non-fiction writer and critic, and it's my very great pleasure to be hosting today's discussion with Oyinko Braithwaite about her debut novel, My Sister, the Serial Killer. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that this session takes place on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional and rightful custodians of the land whose sovereignty was never ceded. And I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Ayula summons me with these words, "Corridae, I killed him." I had hoped that I would never hear those words again. So begins Oyinko Braithwaite's debut novel, My Sister, the Serial Killer, a story of the bloody ties that bind siblings. Once again, the dutiful older sister, Corridae, dons her rubber gloves and pours the bleach, cleaning up yet another mess for her selfish, reckless, and very, very beautiful sister. But when Ayula sets her sights on Corridae's longtime crush, Tade, a doctor at the hospital where Corridae works as a nurse, sibling rivalry is taken to murderous degrees, and Corridae will have to choose between romantic and familial love. "You can't sit on the fence forever," Ayula tells her. It's a book that is macabre, it's sprinkled with a lot of graveyard humour, and it's very compulsively readable. The New York Times called it a scorpion-tailed little thriller which leaves a sting you will remember. Oyinko Braithwaite is a graduate of creative writing and law from Kingston University. Following her degree, she's worked as an editor at a Nigerian publishing house and as a production manager at Apaja World, sorry if I'm saying that wrong, a children's educational entertainment company. She now works as a writer and editor. She lives in Lagos, Nigeria. Please join me in warmly welcoming Oyinko Braithwaite.
Thank you. Actually, I'm really happy everybody's here because I had a little panic attack and I thought nobody would come for this session, so thank you.
It was only when I was typing out the opening lines of your book that I realised that Corridae, I Killed Him, is a play on Reader, I Married Him, the famous line from the conclusion of Jane Eyre. And I read that that Bronte's classic was a bit of an inspiration for you in Corridae's voice. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because it's not a connection that you would think
to make. Do you know
what?
It's not even a connection I made. Like, I'm hearing
oh,
this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm hearing this for the first time. I mean, it makes so much sense, though, because when I did the Waterstones, what was it called? Shelfie. Okay, yeah. The Waterstones Shelfie. You know, it's a little video that they do where you go into Waterstones and you sort of pretend you're seeing books for the first time. You're on the shelf, even though you know exactly where they are, but you sort of pretend you're looking for them and you pick out books that have influenced you. And I always picked Jane Eyre, but I also picked Great Expectations. And as I was talking about it, I realized how much Great Expectations had influenced me and had influenced this book without me even realizing it. So I suppose these sort of stories that have made a huge impression on you, kind of without you having to actively do anything, they seep into your soul and into your storytelling. Mm-hmm. Especially, I mean, with Great Expectations, it was this whole idea of Estella, who, you know, Miss Havisham had been jilted at the altar, and from that day on, as a young woman, but from that day on, she wears her wedding dress every single day until she's really old. And it's such a vivid image. But because of her pain and her bitterness, she raises her ward, Estella, to be this heartbreaker. She, you know, she creates this little man monster, for lack of a better term. And, you know, and I think in many ways, Ayola is that same individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe before we begin in earnest, we'll get you to do a little bit of a reading from the book so those who haven't heard it can get a bit of a taste for Corridae's voice, who it's written in, and kind of see some of the dynamic between the two sisters. So if you wanted to read Bleach, the
All
second
right.
chapter.
"I bet you didn't know that bleach masks the smell of blood. Most people use bleach indiscriminately, assuming it is a catch-all product, never taking the time to read the list of ingredients on the back, never taking the time to return to the recently wiped surface to take a closer look. Bleach will disinfect, but it's not great for cleaning residues, so I use it only after I'd first scrubbed the bathroom of all traces of life and death. It is clear that the room we are in has been remodeled recently. It has that never-been-used look, especially now that I've spent close to 3 hours cleaning up. The hardest part was getting to the blood that had seeped in between the shower and the caulking. It's an easy part to forget. There's nothing placed on any of the surfaces. His shower gel, toothbrush, and toothpaste are all stored in the cabinet above the sink. Then there's the shower mat, a black smiley face on a yellow rectangle in an otherwise white room. Ayla is perched on the toilet seat, her knees raised and her arms wrapped around them. The blood on her dress is dried, and there is no risk that it will drip on the white, now glossy floors. Her dreadlocks are piled atop her head so they don't sweep the ground. She keeps looking up at me with her big brown eyes, afraid that I am angry, that I will soon get off my hands and knees to lecture her. I am not angry. If I am anything, I am tired. The sweat from my brow drips onto the floor, and I use the blue sponge to wipe it away. I was about to eat when she called me. I had laid everything out on the tray in preparation. The fork was to the left of the plate, the knife to the right. I folded the napkin into the shape of a crown and placed it at the center of the plate. The movie was paused at the beginning credits and the oven timer had just rung when my phone began to vibrate violently on my table. By the time I get home, the food will be cold. I stand up and raise the gloves in the sink, but I don't remove them. Ayla is looking at my reflection in the mirror. We need to move the body, I tell her. Are you angry at me? Perhaps a normal person would be angry, but what I feel now is a pressing need to dispose of the body. When I got here, we carried him to the boot of my car so that I was free to scrub and mop without having to countenance his cold stare. Get your bag, I reply. We return to the car, and he's still in the boot waiting for us. The third mainland bridge gets little to no traffic at this time of night, and since there are no lamp lights, it's almost pitch black. But if you look beyond the bridge, you can see the lights of the city. We take him to where we took the last one, over the bridge and into the water. At least he won't be lonely. Some of the blood has seeped into the lining of the boot. Ayla offers to clean it out of guilt, but I take my homemade mixture of 1 spoon of ammonia to 2 cups of water from her and pour it over the stain. I don't know whether or not they have the tech for a thorough crime scene investigation in Lagos, but Ayla could never clean up as efficiently as I can.
Thank you. In such a short chapter, we get so much of an idea of Coriday there, that she's hardworking and practical, and in this very resigned way, she'll do anything that she has to for her to look after her younger sister. But you also get some of that kind of family dynamic coming through. I love the line at the end that rather than her being angry that she's cleaning up yet another dead body, she's like, Ayla could never clean as well as I could. Why did you choose to tell this story through Coriday's eyes rather than the serial killer of the novel's title?
Again, I think it's... I read a short story a really long time ago where there was this... I don't remember very much about it except that the protagonist was obsessed with her sister. She was... You know, so she kept on talking about her and describing her sister. And I didn't want, in so many ways, I wanted Coriday to be an observer as opposed to an active participant. So she treats it as though it's Ayla's story that she's telling, and she's, you know, constantly focused on what Ayla is or is not doing and how Ayla looks and how beautiful Ayla is and how people respond to Ayla. And, you know, she sort of passive in the sense that everything that happens, she's responding to it as opposed to doing anything herself. So I guess it also gave me the, it's from Coriday's point of view, it allowed, gave me the freedom to let Ayla be as ridiculous as I wanted her to be, or as, you know, as bold and as bright and as free as I wanted her to be, because I didn't have to be inside her thoughts and she didn't have to sort of think about why she was doing what she was doing, or, you know, spend any sort of time in introspection. So that's sort of why.
Yeah. I've heard the novel described as a play on the noir genre, but it seems to be playing into true crime as much as that. The fact that, you know, in this genre that we're kind of inundated with at the moment, it's the beautiful young girl who is the mutilated body often at the centre of this. Were you playing with those kind, actively playing with those sort of gender dynamics by having a female murderess?
You know what? It's weird because writing this novel, I didn't really think I was doing anything new. I've always been drawn to strong female characters, and I've always been drawn to strong female characters who are doing nefarious things. That's just been my, you know, and I've, so I guess this idea of a woman being stronger than a man, or of a woman being able to trick a man or, you know, kill a man, I've done it several times. Like, it's not, well, I mean, I have personally done it. I should be careful with the way of, I mean, I'm not, disclaimer, I've not personally done it several times, but I've, you know, I've played with this idea. So I didn't, and I feel like I've seen it done, again, like with Great Expectations. That was, you know, that this was the idea of Estella, that she would somehow have this power that, you know, and I mean, off the top of my head, I can't really, but I've definitely seen it done in literature. So it didn't feel new to me. I didn't feel like I was subverting anything, but I'm asked a lot now, so it's weird because I'm forced to sort of confront it that was I, but I've been influenced by something. I'm not, you know, a product of my own sort of island self. Mm-hmm. So I do think I'm, and I suppose as an individual, I've never felt like there's anything that I couldn't personally do. Mm-hmm. So like my heroines have never been restricted in that sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The notion of the female serial killer isn't one that we get very often when a female killer who is doing so alone, but also one that is as physically beautiful as everybody seems to be saying that Iola is. Charlize Theron famously uglied up to play the serial killer Eileen Wuornos in Monster. How did you go about understanding the psychology of Iola?
Well, like I said, I didn't really have to understand her psychology because I wasn't in her mind ever. Yeah. You know, I was observing the things she was doing as a person who didn't really understand why she was doing what she was doing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of creating her as a character, I think that it was important for me that she be beautiful because the reason she gets away with so much is because she's beautiful and people aren't willing, unable to see past that, and that was very important for me, which is why Corriday is on the other end of the scale, and Corriday is far less attractive than her sister is, because also as a woman, I think that most often where, you know, how you look, you're very quickly judged based on how you look, and how you're treated is based on how you look, and not only is Ayla doing these horrific things, Corriday also has to deal with the fact that she has a sister who's far more attractive than she is, who's far darker than she is, but Corriday is the one who suffers for, you know, pretty much everything, and who doesn't have the love that she wants because she's not attractive enough and she's not bold enough to take it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I answered your question at all.
Yeah, no, you definitely okay. did. Perhaps you could read the sections, the next sections we had, the notebook and the poem, which give us a bit more of a sense of Iola, and also I think some of the book's humour, though from all the giggles in your first reading, I think it's pretty clear.
The notebook. Who was he? Femi. I scribble the name down. We are in my bedroom. Iola is sitting cross-legged on my sofa, her head resting on the back of the cushion. While she took a bath, I set the dress she had been wearing on fire. Now she wears a rose-colored t-shirt and smells of baby powder. And his surname? She frowns, pressing her lips together, and then she shakes her head as though trying to shake the name back into the forefront of her brain. It doesn't come. She shrugs. I should have taken his wallet. I close the notebook. It is small, smaller than the palm of my hand. I watched a TEDx video once where the man said that carrying around a notebook and penning one happy moment each day had changed his life. That is why I bought the notebook. On the first page I wrote, I saw a white owl through my bedroom window. The notebook has been mostly empty since. It's not my fault, you know. But I don't know. I don't know what she's referring to. Does she mean the inability to recall his surname or his death? Tell me what happened. The poem. Femi wrote her a poem. She can remember the poem, but she cannot remember his last name. I dare you to find a flaw in her beauty or to bring forth a woman who can stand beside her without wilting. And he gave it to her, written on a piece of paper, folded twice, reminiscent of our secondary school days when kids would pass love notes to one another in the back row of classrooms. She was moved by all this, but then Ayola is always moved by the worship of her merits, and so she agreed to be his woman. On their 1 month anniversary, she stabbed him in the bathroom of his apartment. She didn't mean to, of course. He was angry, screaming at her, his onion-stained breath hot against her face. But why was she carrying the knife? The knife was for her protection. You never knew with men. They wanted what they wanted when they wanted it. She didn't mean to kill him. She wanted to warn him off, but he wasn't scared of her weapon. He was over 6 foot tall, and she must have looked like a doll to him with her small frame, long eyelashes, and rosy full lips. Her description, not mine. She killed him on the first strike, a jab straight to the heart, but then she stabbed him twice more to be sure. He sank to the floor. She could hear her own breathing and nothing else.
Thank you. So many people in the book, basically everybody except for Coraday, only see Ayola through her physical beauty. It's almost like it blinds everyone to her personality, basically. Were you setting out to comment on female beauty, on the kind of deception of surfaces?
Yes. I mean, to be honest, I think that's why that was really my whole intention with this book. To sort of examine society's kind of obsession with beauty, and like I kind of feel as though you know, we treat beauty as though it's a virtue as opposed to just a characteristic, and I think it dates back like a really long time ago, because even when you look at you know, the literature of old, even when you look at Shakespeare and all that, you've got these, you know, these beautiful pale, you know, long-haired. I remember telling a friend once that all I needed in life was to be happy. I mean, I was about 12, 13 at the time, but I was like, oh my gosh, all I need in life is long hair, and I'll, you know, and everything will be fine. So it's like, I think that, we were kind of fed this one idea of, you know, what beauty was and what beauty looked like, but also that beauty was synonymous with goodness and with kindness, that if you were beautiful, you were a good person. And you know, this is what 9 times out of 10, like the books I read were, you know. So I guess I was playing into that a little bit, like, could you be beautiful and be this sort of horrific individual at the same time, and would people be able to tell if you were, or would they, you know, like when you're watching also all these films or TV shows and you've got the mean girls, you know, and they're always attractive, but they have to be, because nobody will put up with that from someone who isn't attractive. Like, you know, you've not got the platform in which to, people are not going to bow down or put up with it if you're not attractive. So, you know, or you've got this, when you're a little bit less physically attractive, and then, you know, 9 out of 10, maybe you end up being funny or, you know, or kind, because you're sort of making up for maybe what God hasn't given you. So I've got two sisters myself. I've got two sisters and a brother. And growing up, I realized how often we were compared with each other. So that was also something that interested me, that not only is Ayola this beautiful creature who, you know, people can't really see past that, but also Coraday isn't, and she's compared to Ayola, and, you know, she already feels pretty bad about it, but now she feels even worse, somewhat so.
And she's constantly doing that herself within,
yes,
the text. There's a great scene where she tries to sway her hips the way that Ayola does. And he's like, why are you walking funny? Like, have you pulled a muscle? Does Ayola feel some burden in the way that people see her, as, or, you know, the way men respond to her, the expectations her mother has for her? Is she a monster that we've created by the way she's treated as a beautiful person?
I think so. I think I think even that has its own, you know, because she plays into it because she's decided this is the way it is and she's using it to her advantage. But she's also realized far quicker than Coryday has how shallow people are. And, you know, and she's decided to play to it. I think also, you know, the way that you identify yourself. I remember when I was growing up, I was always told how light I was. You know, I was lighter back in the day, and I was always told how light I was. You know, so I grew up thinking, okay, just knowing that about myself, that I was light. For a black woman, I was a light-skinned black woman, and then I got darker at some point, and then you know, it's interesting because people pointed out, in Nigeria, Nigerians point out everything. They'll let you know when you've gained weight. They point out everything, so... And I'm not the most observant individual, so someone always tells me something about myself before, like, I figure it out. So, you know, people started talking about how I was darker, how I was getting darker, and then one day I realized I was no longer light. I was no longer a light-skinned black woman, and I had to think, okay, what does that change for me? How does that affect the way, you know, I'll be received? Like, does it even matter? You know, and it's just... I think it's the same thing if you're told, and usually most of the time we're told these things from when we're very young, you know, you're told if you're pretty or you're just told nothing at all, if you're lucky, if you're not pretty, or like, you know, or you're told when I've been told when I've gained weight, you know, and you sort of have to think, okay, because if nobody said anything, it wouldn't really matter at all. But you're told something. So when you stop being told that thing, you have to reassess yourself and how the world sees you and how you want to engage with the world. So, you know, that's something that was also really important to me when I was writing this book.
One thing I love as well is that Ayola almost acts like a mirror to other people in that all these men reveal their true selves when they're around her. And especially Tade, he kind of... becomes this obsessive, blind follower of her that, you know, he only wants to be with her because he says she's beautiful and perfect. And she tells Coryday he isn't deep, all he wants is a pretty face.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested as well in this relationship that it's not only a dynamic between siblings, but also one between two women, this kind of push-pull of their... hatred sometimes, but also this devotion. Were they always going to be sisters, Coryday and Ayola?
No, not always. In like 2007, I wrote this poem. It was a really long poem. And it was about two friends. And it was a very similar story, even though it was a poem. And a lot changed because it wasn't set in Lagos. It wasn't. There were a lot about it that was different, but the heart of the story was the same. So initially, it was friends. But when I was writing this story, I realized that I didn't want there to be that choice, you know, because you choose who your friends are, but you're stuck with your family. Like, you don't get to choose who your siblings are. You don't get to choose who your parents are. And there's something about that, you know. Like, sometimes I look at my siblings and you just think, we couldn't possibly have come from the same place. Like, how is this even possible? Because they're doing things you don't understand. You know, so Coryday doesn't get the choice. She didn't choose to be tethered to Ayola. She just is. And because she's the eldest sister, it's also ingrained in her that she should look after Ayola and she should be there for Ayola no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe on that note, you could give us one more reading from the chapter Dancing that comes a little bit later, which tells us a bit more about Ayola, but also hints at some of the inheritances that the two sisters have from their father, which is one of the undercurrents of the book.
Okay, Dancing. There is music blasting from Ayola's room. She's listening to Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody. It would be more appropriate to play Brymo or Lord, something solemn or yearning, rather than the musical equivalent of a packet of M&Ms. I want to have a shower, to rinse the smell of the hospital's disinfectant off my skin, but instead I open the door. She doesn't sense my presence. She has her back to me and is thrusting her hips from side to side, her bare feet stroking the white fur rug as she steps this way and that. Her movements are in no way rhythmical. They are the movements of someone who has no audience and no self-consciousness to shackle them. Days ago, we gave a man to the sea, but here she is, dancing. I lean on the doorframe and watch her, trying and failing to understand how her mind works. She remains as impenetrable to me as the elaborate artwork daubed across her walls. She used to have an artist friend who painted the bold black strokes over the whitewash. It feels out of place in this dainty room with its white furniture and plush toys. He would have been better off painting an angel or a fairy. At the time, I could tell that he hoped his generous acts and his artistic talents would secure him a place in her heart, or at the very least, a place in her bed. But he was short and had teeth that were fighting for space in his mouth, so all it got him was a pat on the head and a can of Coke. She starts to sing. Her voice is off key. I clear my throat. Ayola. She turns to me, still dancing. Her smile spreads. How was work? It was all right. Cool. She shakes her hips and bends her knees. I called you. I was busy. Wanted to come and take you out for lunch. Thanks, but I normally eat lunch at work. Okay. Ayola, I begin again gently. Maybe I should take the knife. She slows her movements until all she's doing is swaying side to side with the occasional swing of her arm. What? I said maybe I should take the knife. Why? Well, you don't need it. She considers my words. It takes her the time it takes paper to burn. No thanks, I think I'll hold on to it. She increases the tempo of her dance, whirling away from me. I decide to try a different approach. I pick up her iPod and turn the volume down. She faces me again and frowns. What is it now? It's not a good idea to have it, you know, in case the authorities ever come to the house to search. You could just toss it into the lagoon and reduce the risk of getting caught. She crosses her arms and narrows her eyes. We stare at each other for a moment, then she sighs and drops her arms. The knife is important to me, Koride. It is all I have left of him. Perhaps if it was someone else at the receiving end of this show of sentimentality, her words would hold some weight. But she cannot fool me. It is a mystery how much feeling Ayola is even capable of. I wonder where she keeps the knife. I never come across it except in those moments when I am looking down at the bleeding body before me, and sometimes I don't even see it then. For some reason, I cannot imagine her resorting to stabbing if that particular knife were not in her hand. Almost as if it were the knife and not her that was doing the killing. But then, is that so hard to believe? Who is to say that an object does not come with its own agenda, or that the collective agenda of its previous owners does not direct its purpose still?
Thank you.
Ayola's knife becomes this kind of symbol of their father and the inheritance of their father's violence. And when it appears in the book, when it's remembered, it happens so casually in the way that it ruptures these domestic scenes. You know, one minute they're having dinner and everything is nice, and then someone is being dragged out of the room by their hair, or the things far more abhorrent than that. How much has the legacy of their father affected Ayola and Koride?
I think, you know, I spoke earlier about the fact that Koride didn't choose Ayola, you know, they're sisters and it's just the two of them. But also, aside from that, when I was writing it, I thought this isn't enough to make Koride stick with Ayola, you know, body after body after body. So I kind of realized that they had to, if they had shared trauma, that would bind them even closer, because, you know, when you've been through something with someone, it almost creates like a little bubble that only the people inside, the people who have experienced that, can understand, and everybody outside of that becomes an outsider. So their father, aside from the fact that he is their father and he is their blood, is also their shared trauma. So he's the reason why no one else except for them could really understand how they ended up where they are, how they are the way they are. And also I think, you know, it's a question that Koride struggles with, like how much of her father is in, you know, Ayola, and how much, you know, that whole nurture-nature debate, how much of it is Ayola's just a psychopath or a sociopath, and how much of it is that, you know, she's a victim of the things that happened to her.
Mm-hmm. This kind of father figure, this overbearing, abusive father, is something that's ubiquitous, unfortunately ubiquitous across the world. But I'm wondering if there's any ways that you're kind of speaking to something bigger about the legacies of violence, but that, you know, few Nigerian books that we get to read here often tend to have a backdrop of war. Were you speaking any larger kind of political questions there?
I don't know about larger political questions. I do know that I know a lot of, I'm Nigerian, in case you didn't know. In Nigeria, it's, we still have, not so much nowadays, but we still have corporal punishment. And, I went to a boarding school in Nigeria at some point where, like, teachers could also, use the cane or whatever on you and all that kind of stuff. And I remember seeing, I was never really, I never really experienced it so much personally. I rarely got into trouble, but I used to see it, happen to other, especially guys. And growing up in that environment, I've realized that a lot of people don't have, they're not very close to their parents, especially their dads, because their dads, people who don't even refer to their dad as dad or daddy, who will just call their dad sir, and it's not that they don't love their dad or their dad doesn't love them, but he really was just the authority in their home. He goes off to work, he comes back, and then when it's punishment time, he does the meeting out of the punishment. So it's something that I've seen a lot. Even though I haven't personally experienced it, it was very easy to draw from that for this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time outside Nigeria as well. You lived in England for a long time. How much is this a Nigerian story to you? And did you feel any kind of pressure in your first book to tell a certain kind of Nigerian story?
I think, I have a really strong English influence as far as literature goes, as far as what I've read, probably stronger than my Nigerian influence as far as writing goes. But culture-wise, Nigeria is such an immersive experience. Being in that environment, the culture is very strong. So the more time I've spent there, the more I've drawn from what I see and what I hear. There's so much material there, to be honest. But I think the way I write is more, I wouldn't say it's British. It probably isn't British, but it's not Nigerian either. I don't know. I suppose that's what happens when you've been around, you've moved around quite a bit, as I have. I spent my formative years in England, and then actually most of my education was in England. So there's definitely a lot of that in my work. I did feel, writing this, it was a little bit difficult initially, because I thought, I've not seen this kind of story set in Nigeria before, and I wasn't sure I'd be able to pull it off. Mm-hmm. I really wasn't sure anybody would buy into it. It's not the first story I've written. It's not the first novel I've written, so it wasn't necessarily there was the pressure of, oh my gosh, this is my first novel that I've written based on. But I really did want to have fun with it. And I didn't aim to have it published. That wasn't what I was going for. So I had the freedom at the time to have fun, to play around with it, which made it really easy and didn't give me the kind of anxiety that I'm having these days. but then it was, I could just do whatever I thought would work for this particular story.
It's also such a strong portrait of the city, the kind of thunderous rain and the traffic jams, the very casually corrupt policemen that recur throughout the book. Did you find that the time that you'd spent away from the city helped you see it in any kind of different light?
I'm not the most observant person, so I don't think that made a difference.
Yeah.
It's funny because when I don't even think that scene was in the first draft. It was when I was working with the editors and they were like, your book is too small. And I had to kind of figure out ways that I thought, okay, do you know what, I'm going to have this scene. But What's been most interesting to me is how, I mean, again, because I'm not the most observant, I don't look at Lagos as an outsider most of the time. So I miss some things. And since this book has come out, I realized how it's more obvious to me how horrific that scene looks to people outside of Nigeria, when for me, it's like my day-to-day existence. Like, that's how the police are all the time. I hate them. That wasn't even really police. That was a traffic official. But they really are like pests. And so when I was writing it, I wasn't writing it thinking, oh my gosh, I'm shedding light on this scenario. I was just writing another like typical day in Lagos, but it turned out that people were like, oh my gosh, this is horrible.
On a similar note, there's very particular class dynamics and some political dynamics that the book's touching on when Korede is pulled over by those traffic police. Mm. She starts speaking in broken English to hide her education. In the house, they have house girls helping with the kind of domestic duties. Could you explain a bit more about the family's class position and perhaps how that influences the way the sisters act with such impunity?
We've still got a really strong... We inherited it from the British, so we've still got a really strong sense of class. There's a very, there's a wide gap between the rich and the poor. So the other day I was coming back from a wedding and I was driving and I wasn't 100% sure about how to find my way back or how to find my way to the reception. Yeah, that was what it was. And so I was using Google Maps, which Google Maps in Nigeria is like a touch and go sort of affair because Nigeria changes so fast and Google Maps isn't aware of it. Anyway, so it was taking me down this route and I remember thinking, this looks like a bus route, but Google Maps was telling me to take it. So I was like, okay. And I got on it and literally like these lasma, they came out from like these pillars. And that's what they do, they hide. So they came out from these pillars and one of them was holding this L-shaped instrument that had spikes on it like this. So basically I couldn't move forward because if I do, it'll puncture my tires. So I had to stop. And anyway, what usually happens is that they want, which is very similar to the scene, they want you to pay your way out of the situation. So because they're very poorly paid, like they are actually, they're very poorly paid. So they find unique ways to pad their income. And but I didn't have money on me. I didn't have cash. And there was no ATM nearby or anything like that. So, I'm there trying to talk myself out of the situation. And then at some point he says, okay, do you know what? Call your husband. And I'm not married. Like, I didn't even have a ring on my finger. But he just decided, like, we've got to get, like, a man in this situation. Like, you've got to call in a man to come and sort out the situation. And, I had to explain to him that, look, I was single. Like, we had to sort it out between ourselves. I got out of it in the end. I did pay out. I found a way to pay my way out of the situation. There is that like interesting thing where I've realized that sometimes when they stop you, either they're offended by the fact that there's this woman who has more, who's more comfortable than they are. Like I've had, people say, oh, I've got a daughter that's the same age as you or whatever, like who are offended by just by you. They're just offended, and because also they have a hard life and it doesn't seem fair to them that this young woman should, be driving her own car and going about her business and all of that. And like, there's no man who seems to be, paying her way or whatever. But we do have that. We have a lot of labor is very cheap in Nigeria and we still have these, your homes are fairly big if you can afford it. So, you do have staff, that clean, that live in staff. So we have, house girls, drivers, gate men, that sort of thing. So it's not, back in the day, people used to treat their staff quite badly, but now people are much better. Like they'll have their staff go to school or pay their way, through. Because a lot of the time these guys are coming, the people that work for you are maybe coming from the villages or, or are basically just from really low income backgrounds. So yeah, there are a lot of, it's a normal structure in Nigeria. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier you weren't sure if people were going to buy this story, if they were going to buy into it. It's been incredibly well received internationally, but I'm wondering how people received it at home in Nigeria.
You know, it's still not so well known in Nigeria. I mean, I think a little bit more since the shortlist, but it's still not that well known there. I think it's also because I wasn't in the writing community in Nigeria before this book. Like, I kind of was just like writing in my room by myself or doing my own little thing. So I don't think the community has quickly embraced me in that sense. But also, I don't know. They just, yeah, they've not really come to the book. But sometimes, you know, I had someone say to me once, like, didn't I think that I was influencing people negatively? You know, like, what if, you know, women started committing murders and stuff? And
well, you've already done three.
Yeah. So, but I feel like if anyone did try and use, like, clearly you were already planning to. I don't think my book is gonna like trigger that sort of violence.
No, I don't think so either. The one thing about the writing is that it's so vivid and it's so cinematic, and I've heard that the book's film rights have been optioned. In your dream movie, who will play Iola and Coraday?
Do you know what? I have no idea. I keep being asked. I should come up with an answer to this question. I have no idea. You know, I almost kind of just, I try not to think about the film too much because I don't want to. Because with options, you don't actually know if it's going to go ahead and be made. And I also realize I have no power. Mm-hmm. So, like, I've signed off all my rights. So even if I picked someone, like, they'd probably not
go with that person. No, but you have to fantasize, right?
I don't know. I think I would like, it would be nice if they had one or two actual Nigerian, mm-hmm. As opposed to people pretending to be Nigerian. It would be nice if they had, they put some Nigerian talent in it. I think I'd really like that, but I don't know specifically. I think I'd want to see someone new, mm-hmm. mostly, especially for the women. For the men, I don't really mind, but for the women, I definitely want to see someone new, just because I don't like it when Hollywood does this thing where they keep just using the same like set of black people to do like every movie. So I think we need more black talent out there. So mm-hmm. I think that's what I want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I'll just ask one more question before we open it up to the audience. So get thinking. I'm sure you've got a lot. You talked earlier about how you wrote this book just for you, that this process was just for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how, now that you've had this book that has you touring around the world, potentially a film happening, how you maintain that writing process where it's just for you?
Okay, so I wanted to write since I was about... I've known I wanted to be an author since I was about, like, 9, 10. So I've been working towards that. Like, you know, my degree was in creative writing and law, and I've been, you know, entering competitions and all of that. You know, so I've been working towards it for a while. And so when I was 29, you know, I could see 30, and I was not impressed. Like, I thought, oh, my God, like, this is something you've wanted to do pretty much all your life, and you've never even sent work to an agent. By then, I had written two novels, but I hadn't sent anything, you know. I mean, I'd also been shortlisted for the Commonwealth by then, but I hadn't sent any work outside of that. And I was starting to panic, you know. So I decided, okay, do you know what? By the end of this year, you will at least have sent the work out. And it's funny because by the end of that year, my book was already signed, you know. So it was really kind of, it was really, but like that particular, when I was writing it, I wrote it in a frenzy. Like this book, I wrote it because I was panicking. I didn't, you know, even though I said by the end of the year I would have sent out a book, I actually wrote this book in order to push past whatever was, you know, whatever shackles were on my, I thought, you know, you're going to write something fun and light. You're not going to, nobody's going to really see it. You're going to write something for yourself.
Light and then about
yes, no one's going to see it. And then you can write the great novel. So this book was meant to be the precursor to the great novel. And then what happened was, why I ended up sending it out was because, After the Commonwealth Short Story Prize, the agency who would later become my agents had reached out to me. And I mean, I didn't win that, by the way, because it sounds like I won it, but I didn't. But I was shortlisted, and they had reached out to me. So after I wrote this book, because a year had gone by since then, and I thought, oh my God, they're going to forget about me. So when I wrote this book, I wrote it to them basically saying, oh, I just, you know, wrote this little novella, and it was much smaller then, you know, but I'm working on the novel, just to let you know. So that's kind of how. But since then, to be honest, it's been tough to write as consistently as I used to because I'm moving around more. And I have more anxiety than I had initially. But whenever, what I tend to do is whenever I do get into that space, I try and commit to writing 1,000 words a day. That's usually... That's what I kind of need to do to feel like I've done writing for that day. Everybody's different, but if I write less than 1,000 words, I go about feeling like I've not quite done the work I'm meant to do. I'm not someone who, I try to write quickly because otherwise I'll start to have second thoughts about the story that I'm writing and then I'll jump into another one. Like that's kind of my thing. So that's usually what I do.
Well, we're all very much looking forward to whatever comes out of it. Does anyone have any questions? We have two. We've got some volunteers anyway with roving mics. So if you just wanted to pop your hand up and they will come around to you.
Hello. I just wanted to ask, is that the guy in Dubai? Like, what actually happened to him? What were you thinking?
Sorry, I can't...
The boyfriend in Dubai?
Yes.
What did she actually do in your mind?
Do you know what? It's going to sound terrible, but I'm not 100% sure. The kind of writer I am, I try not to know... Like, the books for me, it's more fun if I don't know everything about, like, my characters or everything about the story because I feel like I'm discovering along the way. So I kind of like the idea that she could or could not have been behind... I think it was a coincidence. I think it was what she said it was to some extent because, you know, she uses her knife, so, yeah.
Thank you. We had another one at the front.
Hi.
Hi.
I loved your book. I'm an older sister. I'm the eldest. So I really related to Corday. And there were certain times when I was reading and I was just so frustrated for her because I wanted her to get what she wanted.
Yeah.
And did you feel frustrated when you were writing that? Like, did you want Corday to succeed once instead of Ayula? Or was that always the point?
It wasn't always the point. When I started writing it out, I didn't actually know how it was going to end. You know, and there was like this, I know a lot of people felt frustrated that she didn't, you know, but I think there was a sense of she came to terms with things, you know. So even though she didn't get happiness in the way that we interpret happiness, she no longer had that struggle that, you know, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on? She came to terms with it and was at peace with, you know, how her life was and was going to continue to be.
Thank you.
I heard that you...
Sorry, where are you? Okay, sorry. I'm not wearing my glasses. I'm so confused. Okay.
I heard that you... one of your favourite books is Jane Eyre. I was wondering how that influenced this book, because it's almost similar, you know, the kind of the horror, gothic storyline, you know, paraded under the, you know, love triangle. So I was wondering, how did that influence you?
I mean, I couldn't say, like, actively how it affected it, but I've read, you know, Jane Eyre quite a bit in the course of my life, and I've, you know, I have my favourite passages and stuff, so I'm pretty sure it has influenced my work generally, maybe not even specifically this. And also, you know, again, it's something that I realised more now, you know, the fact that it's first person, you know, the fact that Jane isn't considered to be very attractive, you know, and, you know, she's had a somewhat hard life. I can see the similarities now, but at the time I wasn't thinking of Jane Eyre at all.
We had another question at the front. Yep.
Hi, thank you. My question is, you mentioned that you've become more nervous now about writing, and when you initially started, you were less nervous. And I'm just interested in that. Is that because of the success in this book has now raised expectations of the world that you must write another even more wonderful novel?
Yeah, definitely there's that. There's also, you know, definitely the success, because it makes me feel like, oh my gosh, people might, you know, I don't know how to, whatever expectations they have, I don't know how to meet it. But also, people seem to think I'm a comedic writer, which I was not expecting, and this gives me the worst anxiety, because I don't think that my writing is generally funny, and I don't know if I can continue to write in that tone or in that style. So it's sort of getting past that, oh, maybe this is the time to be a little bit funny now. Like, I don't know, you know, that kind of is kind of holding me back a bit.
So was that humour not intentional, or was it something that came out?
I wasn't trying to be funny. That's the worst thing about it. Like, I knew I was writing something that was dark, and I didn't want it to be overly dark. I wanted it to have a bit of lightness to it, but not even playfulness. I wasn't trying to be playful. And my mom was reading the book recently, and she said in the first chapter where I think when I said, when Korede says, at least he won't be lonely or something like that, and she was like, oh gosh, that sounds so much like you. And I thought, you know, maybe that's just the way I talk, maybe, I don't know, but I definitely wasn't trying. I just needed, I think the characters are so matter of fact about things that they shouldn't be matter of fact about, that's what I think makes it a little bit funny. But it came as news to me when, you know, I saw the reviews and people were calling it a dark comedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. do we have any other questions, if you want to pop your hand up?
So with earlier how you were saying that you were really interested in kind of like women with like kind of this darker motivation and everything, do you think in your next novel you want to continue to kind of explore those themes of like the kind of like the siren, like the kind of darker motivations, or do you want to kind of explore other areas going forward?
Darker motivations, definitely. I don't know. I think, so far as I can tell from what I've written thus far and the things I try to write, I think definitely women doing dodgy things is a draw for me, or being in dodgy situations, even if they're not the, you know, being in tight, awkward, dark situations is definitely something I'm interested in for the time being.
We probably have time for one more quick question. Did you say there was one down the front?
Hi.
Hi.
So food. I love that you put all this detail about food in the book. And was that intentional? And what's Ayola's favourite food?
Ayola's favourite food? I mean, I think I'll go with ice cream. There's a whole chapter because of maybe ice cream. But yeah, I think that, I mean, you know, Nigerians, we eat a lot. So, you know, I think it's a very sort of natural thing for me to do. And I think also it's a good way to, when it comes to, I think, trying to represent a culture, food is a good way to, it's a good way to go. So I think it's definitely something that to be honest, I'm trying to stay away from it. I'm trying to find more interesting ways to sort of portray my culture and that, other than just going to food. But there's definitely a lot of material there, because people haven't really been exposed to Nigerian food, and you don't see, and even the literature in Nigeria that you have, you don't necessarily always see a lot about food. So
Thank you so much. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Please go and grab a copy of this wonderful book if you don't have one yet from the festival bookshop. Ayinka has also very generously agreed to sign books afterwards. So if you have another question, maybe she can answer it in the line. Please join me in thanking the very wonderful Ayinka.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.